Audio recorders, quit it, stop it, don't take up so much space. Oh, get out of the way. Oh no, this is going terribly. Okay. A brother and sister, or two brothers, for sex here is not at work, grow to a certain age, sharing everything. They have read the same comics, climbed the same trees, been pirates or spacemen together, taken up an abandoned stamp collecting at the same moment. Then a dreadful thing happens. One of them flashes ahead, discovers poetry or science or serious music, or perhaps undergoes a religious conversion. His life is flooded with a new interest. The other cannot share it. He is left behind. I doubt whether even the infidelity of a wife or husband raises a more miserable sense of desertion or a fiercer jealousy than this can sometimes do. It is not yet jealousy of the new friends whom the deserter will soon be making. That will come. At first, it is jealousy of the thing itself. Of this science, this music, of God, always called religion or all this religion in such contexts. The jealousy will probably be expressed by ridicule. The new interest is all silly nonsense, contemptibly childish, or contemptibly grown up, or else the deserter is not really interested in it at all. He is showing off, swanking. It's all affectation. I don't think I can do this with the audio recorder on top. Hang on. Ah! Ah! I lost the page! Oh no! Oh no! I'm gonna have to edit it somehow. Oh god, maybe I should start over. Oh. I went too many pages back. Hang on. Okay, here we go. I'm gonna... app info. Keep open? Great. Okay. Alright, we're getting back into it. Presently, the books will be hidden, the scientific specimens destroyed, the radio forcibly switched off the classical programs. For affection is the most instinctive, in that sense the most animal of the loves. Its jealousy is proportionally fierce. It snarls and bares its teeth like a dog whose food has been snatched away. And why would it not? Something or someone has snatched away from the child I am picturing his lifelong food, his second self. His world is in ruins. But it is not only children who react thus. Few things in the ordinary peacetime life of a civilized country are more nearly fiendish than the rancor with which a whole unbelieving family will turn on the one member of it who has become a Christian, or a whole lowbrow family on the one who showed signs of becoming an intellectual. This is not, as I once thought, simply the innate and, as it were, disinterested hatred of darkness for light. A church-going family in which one has gone atheist will not always behave any better. It is the reaction to a desertion, even to robbery. Someone or something has stolen our boy or girl. He who is one of us has become one of them. What right had anybody to do it? He is ours. But once change has thus begun, who knows where it will end? And we are also happy and comfortable before and doing no harm to no one. Double negative. Sometimes a curious double jealousy is felt, or rather two inconsistent jealousies which chase each other round in the sufferer's mind. On the one hand, this is all nonsense, all bloody highbrow nonsense, all canting humbug. But on the other, supposing, it can't be, it mustn't be, but just supposing, there were something in it. Supposing there really were anything in literature, or in Christianity. How, if the deserter has really entered a new world which the rest of us never suspected? But, if so, how unfair. Why him? Why was it never open to us? A chit of a girl, a whippersnapper of a boy, being shown things that are hidden from their elders? And since that is clearly incredible and unendurable, jealousy returns to the hypothesis, all nonsense. Parents in this state are much more comfortably placed than brothers and sisters. Their past is unknown to their children. Whatever the deserter's new world is, they can always claim that they have been through it themselves and come out the other end. It's a phase, they say, it'll blow over. Nothing could be more satisfactory. It cannot be there and then refuted, for it is a statement about the future. It stings, yet, so indulgently said, is hard to resent. Better still, the elders may really believe it. Best of all, it may finally turn out to have been true. It won't be their fault if it doesn't. Boy, boy, these wild courses of yours will break your mother's heart. That eminently Victorian appeal may often have been true. Affection was bitterly wounded when one member of the family fell from the homely ethos into something worse. Gambling, drink, keeping an opera girl. Those opera girls, you gotta stay away from them. Unfortunately, it is almost equally possible to break your mother's heart by rising above the homely ethos. The conservative tenacity of affection works both ways. It can be a domestic counterpart to the nationally suicidal type of education which keeps back the promising child because the idlers and dunces might be hurt if it were undemocratically moved into a higher class than themselves. All these perversions of affection are mainly connected with affection as a need love, but affection as a gift love has its perversions too. I remember this part really well. I am thinking of Mrs. Fidget, who died a few months ago. It is really astonishing how her family have brightened up. The drawn looks have gone from her husband's face. Yeah, this was so sad. He begins to be able to laugh. The younger boy, whom I had always thought an embittered, peevish little creature, turns out to be quite human. The elder, who is hardly ever at home except when he was in bed, is nearly always there now and has begun to reorganize the garden. The girl, who was always supposed to be delicate, though I never found out what exactly the trouble was, now has the riding lessons which were once out of the question, dances all night, and plays any amount of tennis. Even the dog, who was never allowed out except on a lead, is now a well-known member of the lamppost club in their road. Mrs. Fidget very often said that she lived for her family, and it was not untrue. Everyone in the neighborhood knew it. She lives for her family, they said. What a wife and mother! She did all the washing. True, she did it badly, and they could have afforded to send it out to a laundry, and they frequently begged her not to do it, but she did. There was always a hot lunch for anyone who was at home, and always a hot meal at night, even in midsummer. They implored her not to provide this. They protested, almost with tears in their eyes, and with truth, that they liked cold meals. It made no difference. She was living for her family. She always sat up to welcome you home if you were out late at night. 2 or 3 in the morning, it made no odds. You would find the frail, pale, weary face awaiting you like a silent accusation, which meant, of course, that you couldn't with any decency go out very often. She was always making things, too, being in her own estimation, I'm no judge myself, an excellent amateur dressmaker and a great knitter. And, of course, unless you were a heartless brute, you had to wear the things. The vicar tells me that since her death, the contributions of that family alone to sales of work outweigh those of all his other parishioners put together. And then her care for their health. She bore the whole burden of that daughter's delicacy alone. The doctor, an old friend, and it was not being done on national health, was never allowed to discuss matters with his patient. After the briefest examination of her, he was taken into another room by the mother. The girl was to have no worries, no responsibility for her own health, only loving care, caresses, special foods, horrible tonic wines, and breakfast in bed. For Mrs. Fidget, as she so often said, would work her fingers to the bone for her family. They couldn't stop her, nor could they, being decent people, quite sit still and watch her do it. They had to help. Indeed, they were always having to help. That is, they did the things for her to help her to do things for them which they didn't want done. As for the dear dog, it was to her, she said, just like one of the children. It was, in fact, as like one of them as she could make it. But since it had no scruples, it got on rather better than they, and though vetted, dieted, and guarded within an inch of its life, contrived sometimes to reach the dustbin or the dog next door. The vicar says Mrs. Fidget is now at rest. Let us hope she is. What's quite certain is that her family are. Man, what a story. That one really stuck with me. It is easy to see how liability to this state is, so to speak, congenital in the maternal instinct. This, as we saw, is a gift love, but one that needs to give, therefore needs to be needed. But the proper aim of giving is to put the recipient in a state where he no longer needs our gift. We feed children in order that they may soon be able to feed themselves. We teach them in order that they may soon not need our teaching. Thus a heavy task is laid upon this gift love. It must work towards its own abdication. We must aim at making ourselves superfluous. The hour when we can say, they need me no longer, should be our reward. But the instinct, simply in its own nature, has no power to fulfill this law. The instinct desires the good of its object, but not simply, only the good it can itself give. A much higher love, a love which desires the good of the object as such, from whatever source that good comes, must step in and help or tame the instinct before it can make the abdication. And of course it often does. But where it does not, the ravenous need to be needed will gratify itself either by keeping its objects needy or by inventing for them imaginary needs. It will do this all the more ruthlessly because it thinks, in one sense truly, that it is a gift love and therefore regards itself as unselfish. It is not only mothers who can do this. All those other affections which, whether by derivation from parental instinct or by similarity of function, need to be needed, may fall into the same pit. The affection of patron for protege is one. In Jane Austen's novel, Emma intends that Harriet Smith should have a happy life, but only the sort of happy life which Emma herself has planned for her. My own profession, that of a university teacher, is in this way dangerous. If we are any good, we must always be working towards the moment at which our pupils are fit to become our critics and rivals. We should be delighted when it arrives, as the fencing master is delighted when his pupil can pink and disarm him, and many are. But not all. I'm old enough to remember the sad case of Dr. Quartz. No university boasted a more effective or devoted teacher. He spent the whole of himself on his pupils. He made an indelible impression on nearly all of them. He was the object of much well-merited hero worship. Naturally and delightfully, they continued to visit him after the tutorial relation had ended, went round to his house of an evening, and had famous discussions. But the curious thing is that this never lasted. Sooner or later, it might be within a few months or even within a few weeks, came the fatal evening when they knocked on his door and were told that the doctor was engaged. After that, he would always be engaged. They were banished from him forever. This was because, at their last meeting, they had rebelled. They had asserted their independence, differed from the master, and supported their own view, perhaps not without success. Faced with that very independence which he had labored to produce, and which it was his duty to produce if he could, Dr. Quartz could not bear it. Wotan had toiled to create the free Siegfried. Presented with the free Siegfried, he was enraged. Dr. Quartz was an unhappy man. This terrible need to be needed often finds its outlet in pampering an animal. To learn that someone is fond of animals tells us very little until we know in what way. For there are two ways. On the one hand, the higher and domesticated animal is, so to speak, a bridge between us and the rest of nature. We all at times feel somewhat painfully our human isolation from the subhuman world. The atrophy of instinct, which our intelligence entails, our excessive self-consciousness, the innumerable complexities of our situation, our inability to live in the present. If only we could shuffle it all off. We must not, and incidentally we can't, become beasts. But we can be with a beast. It is personal enough to give the word with a real meaning, yet it remains very largely an unconscious little bundle of biological impulses. It has three legs in nature's world and one in ours. It is a link, an ambassador. Who would not wish, as Bosanquet put it, to have a representative at the court of Pan? Gosh, that's such a good quote. Man with dog closes a gap in the universe, but of course animals are often used in a worse fashion. If you need to be needed, and if your family very properly declined to need you, a pet is the obvious substitute. You could keep it all its life in need of you. You can keep it permanently infantile, reduce it to permanent invalidism, cut it off from all genuine animal well-being, and compensate for this by creating needs for countless little indulgences which only you can grant. The unfortunate creature thus becomes very useful to the rest of the household. It acts as a sump or drain. You are too busy spoiling a dog's life to spoil theirs. Dogs are better for this purpose than cats. A monkey, I am told, is best of all. Also, it is more like the real thing. To be sure, it's all very bad luck for the animal, but probably it cannot fully realize the wrong you have done it. Better still, you would never know if it did. The most downtrodden human, driven too far, may one day turn and blurt out a terrible truth. Animals can't speak. Those who say, the more I see of men, the better I like dogs, those who find in animals a relief from the demands of human companionship, will be well advised to examine their real reasons. I hope I'm not being misunderstood. If this chapter leaves anyone to doubt that the lack of natural affection is an extreme depravity, I shall have failed. Nor do I question for a moment that affection is responsible for 9/10 of whatever solid and durable happiness there is in our natural lives. I shall therefore have some sympathy with those whose comment on the last few pages takes the form, of course these things do happen. Selfish or neurotic people can twist anything, even love, into some sort of misery or exploitation. But why stress these marginal cases? A little common sense, a little give and take, prevents their occurrence among decent people. But I think this comment itself needs a commentary. Firstly, as to neurotic, I do not think we shall see things more... I should pause when I cough. It's okay. We're learning. This is practice. I do not think we shall see things more clearly by classifying all these malefical states of affection as pathological. No doubt there are really pathological conditions which make the temptation to these states abnormally hard or even impossible to resist for particular people. Send those people to the doctors, by all means. But I believe that everyone who is honest with himself will admit that he has felt these temptations. Their occurrence is not a disease, or if it is, the name of that disease is being a fallen man. In ordinary people, the yielding to them, and who does not sometimes yield, is not disease, but sin. Spiritual direction will here help us more than medical treatment. Medicine labors to restore natural structure or normal function, but greed, egoism, self-deception, and self-pity are not unnatural or abnormal, in the same sense as astigmatism or a floating kidney. For who, in heaven's name, would describe as natural or normal the man from whom these feelings were wholly absent? Natural, if you like, in a quite different sense. Arch-natural, unfallen. We have seen only one such man, and he was not at all like the psychologist's picture of the integrated, balanced, adjusted, happily married, employed popular citizen. You can't really be very well adjusted to your world if it says you have a devil and ends by nailing you up and naked to a stake of wood. But secondly, the comment in its own language admits the very thing I am trying to say. Affection produces happiness if and only if there is common sense and give and take and decency. In other words, only if something more and other than affection is added. The mere feeling is not enough. You need common sense, that is reason. You need give and take, that is, you need justice. Continually stimulating mere affection when it fades and restraining it when it forgets or would defy the art of love. You need decency. There is no disguising the fact that this means goodness. Patience, self-denial, humility, and the continual intervention of a far higher sort of love than affection in itself can ever be. That is the whole point. If we try to live by affection alone, affection will go bad on us. How bad, I believe we seldom recognize. Can Mrs. Fidget really have been quite unaware of the countless frustrations and miseries she inflicted on her family? It passes belief. She knew, of course she knew, that it spoiled your whole evening to know that when you came home you would find her uselessly, accusingly sitting up for you. She continued all these practices because she... oh, man. Wow, this is actually really hard. I'm so sorry. Okay, that's alright. That's alright. You're getting the raw, unfiltered Four Loves audiobook, which I don't think you'll mind. Also, you're asleep. Also, I love you. I'm gonna try to keep going till the end of the affection chapter, okay? Also, this recording is just for you, so you know. How bad I believe we seldom recognize. Can Mrs. Fidget really have been quite unaware of the countless frustrations and miseries she inflicted on her family? It passes belief. She knew, of course she knew, that it spoiled your whole evening to know that when you came home you would find her uselessly, accusingly sitting up for you. She continued all these practices because if she had dropped them, she would have been faced with the facts she was determined not to see, would have known that she was not necessary. That is the first motive. Then, too, the very laboriousness of her life silenced her secret doubts as to the quality of her love. The more her feet burned and her back ached, the better, for this pain whispered in her ear, how much I must love them if I do all this. That is the second motive. But I think there is a lower depth. The unappreciativeness of the others, those terrible wounding words, anything will wound a Mrs. Fidget, in which they begged her to send the washing out, enabled her to feel ill-used, therefore to have a continual grievance, to enjoy the pleasures of resentment. If anyone says he does not know those pleasures, he is a liar or a saint. It is true that they are pleasures only to those who hate, but then a love like Mrs. Fidget's contains a good deal of hatred. It was a verotic love that the Roman poet said, I love and hate, but other kinds of love admit the same mixture. They carry in them the seeds of hatred. If affection is made the absolute sovereign of a human life, the seeds will germinate. Love, having become a god, becomes a demon. End of the chapter. Next one's friendship. It's really good. It's really good, and I think you're really gonna like it. Okay. Love you.